Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to our show. Today is Thursday, November 6th, and it's 6 o'clock Eastern Time. If you're listening live, we'd love to have you call in with your questions at 1-718-766-4332. And I know Kate is here.
It's the record. I'm here.
Yay. Kate, you want to do your little introduction?
Yes, I do. I'm Kate Hensler. I am a developmental interventionist. In some states, they call us developmental therapists. I work with children of all different varieties, but most of the children in First Steps, in our, which is what we call our early intervention program, are language delayed, and so Laura and I have that connection. Although she's the real speech language pathologist, I also work on communication skills all day long. So
that's why our show is Teach Me to Talk. That's primarily, it's all I do, and certainly the bulk of your caseload too, children with language delays and language disorders. And tonight we're starting a new series that's going to last the next month and a half. And we're going to be talking about autism, and it is such a prevalent topic right now. I think it's one of the most common questions I'm asked when I go in for a new evaluation. Is my child autistic? Do you think he's meets the criteria for autism? I think parents are so concerned about that right now because the statistics for having a child with autism are just staggering. When I first started looking at statistics, gosh, well over 10 years ago, it was probably 950, wasn't it, Kate? Do you remember that?
That sounds about right. I would have said
right under 1,000.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the latest research tells us that 1 in 150 children, and it's worse if you're a boy, 1 in 99 boys will be diagnosed with autism, and that is so scary. And especially for a parent who's looking at a child that's not talking because of the prevalence that we're hearing about. You know, we hear about autism on television. We read about it in the supermarket, tabloids. You know, it's just everywhere. And I do think it's certainly something that parents of late talkers always wonder, could my child be autistic? So tonight we're going to start a new series about that and talk about just the kind of things that we see. And let's just start by saying we are not specialist in autism. We certainly see children with autism. We treat children with autism, but I would never dare say that that's a topic where I think I'm an expert because I certainly know that there are tons of people that specialize in that. We're going to have in the next 3 weeks, we're going to have our friend on that's a pediatric psychologist who certainly does officially diagnose autism. But from our perspective, we are just going to start to talk about this and about the things that we see in our practices and just characteristics that might make a parent be concerned and want to follow up for further evaluation.
But as you said, Laura, and she's right, neither one of us is an expert in autism, but as people who work with kids who are delayed, 0 to 3, you have to really kind of, over time anyway, kind of educate yourself and learn what works and what doesn't and how to effectively treat and help kids make progress because, I mean, I joke, Laura and I are phone buddies, whether we're doing the show or just between therapy sessions, and I always say, I think I might be an autism expert. And
yeah.
By that, I'm joking, I'm not an autism expert, but we get so many kids who at least appear to be and may or may not ever get a diagnosis in our time span under 3, but so I joke because it just seems so common. Even in the 10 years I've been working with young kids, I see so many more kids who appear to have some tendencies in that direction than I did 10 years ago, and that's remarkable to me because 10 years doesn't seem like that terribly long, but like you said, the statistics do bear that out. It's so much more common today than it was even 10 years ago. And I was surprised to see, Laura, in some of the literature that you shared with me in preparing for the show, that autism was even just diagnosed in 1980.
I know.
Official,
that's the first time that it was listed in the DSM-4, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders. And the first time that autism appeared there was 1980. And my husband and I, who also talk about, you know, our website at teachmetotalk.com and, you know, with how long we've been married and I've been doing this job, he certainly has become a little bit of a speech junkie himself, which is what I call moms and interested others who tend to kind of like this stuff as much as we do since we talk about it all the time. You know, he really talks about growing up, we might not have called that kid autistic or he might not have ever gotten that diagnosis, you know, thinking about his childhood acquaintances, but now certainly, you know, those kinds of children are better diagnosed and diagnosed at earlier ages. Then they might have just been called quirky or, you know, some other maybe less flattering term. But certainly the official diagnosis for autism wasn't really recognized until 1980, and that was interesting to me too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Shall we proceed?
Let's proceed.
Okay.
So, I found this great tool when Kate and I were preparing, or this great link, and it's called the Plain English Interpretation of the DSM-4 Criteria for Autism. And again, this is not a diagnostic tool. It was just written to help us better understand all the symptoms that comprise autism. And we can start by talking about autism is really a spectrum, meaning that there's a wide range of severity. You might have a kid that's severely autistic who has lots and lots of these things that we're going to talk about, who might meet most of the criteria, and in a second I'm going to introduce that, you know, in several different categories. Or you might have a kid that may only barely meet the criteria, but they would still be considered on the spectrum. And that's kind of the term that professionals use to talk about autism, you know, autism spectrum disorders, ASD. But typically, don't you hear people, Kate, just refer to it as on the spectrum?
Yes, in practice, that's generally, you know, they're on the spectrum. It's kind of a matter of degree as to where they might fall on that spectrum, but you know, loosely speaking, they have enough of the tendencies that they probably would get an official diagnosis, whether they've gotten it or not. That's how I think of it anyway.
Me too. And so the official definition or spectrum includes children with autism, children with childhood disintegrative disorder, Asperger's syndrome, Rett syndrome, and pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, and again, that's abbreviated usually as PDD-NOS. So again, all those particular diagnoses fall under what professionals would say is on the spectrum. But to officially be diagnosed with autism, professionals usually observe your child, interview you about behaviors and characteristics and things that you note. And then they could also use other tools or protocols or tests. And, again, we're not going to talk about these specifically tonight, but in 2 weeks, Dr. Lisa Powell is coming on to talk about that with us, and she'll be explaining more of that at that time and explaining the differences between the tools that she uses and also give us kind of cutting edge with what treatment research is telling us works best for children diagnosed with autism.
And generally, I'm sorry, Laura.
Go ahead.
I was going to confirm, this is my belief, that kind of it's most appropriate that a psychologist and specifically a child psychologist would diagnose a child with autism.
Yeah, or a multidisciplinary team. And
yeah,
that would be and that would be a team of professionals. In our area, we send them all to a university-affiliated program. There's usually a developmental pediatrician that looks at the child, a child psychologist, a speech-language pathologist, maybe an occupational therapist. And again, they all look at the child in the various areas, interview the parents, and then make a determination about whether they feel like the child meets the diagnostic criteria. And sometimes it's not as easy as it sounds. It is not like going in and taking your blood pressure and saying you have high blood pressure. You know, it is not as objective as that. But what the DSM-4 tries to do is really give some categories that you have to look, and every time I read this, I get really confused and think, okay, wait a minute, what are these categories? How many does he have to have from this one, and how many does he have to have from this one to officially get that diagnosis? So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And again, I love this, that it's called the Plain English Interpretation of the DSM-IV, and I am going to have that on the website later at teachmetotalk.com. If you as a parent or a professional want to take a look at this, I think this is a great way to kind of help you organize your thoughts about autism.
I agree, okay. Because the DSM-IV stuff, we were saying before the show, I've read it and read it and read it and really tried to determine, does this really, it just, you know, to me, isn't clear, and I like the way this breaks it down so that it does become more clear. You know, it's hard to read that and really understand what it means. But
well, and it's in such professional terminology, and again, it is a little bit confusing if you're not used to administering these kinds of tools. You know, any time that I have something that has more than two numbers in the instructions, I get a little bit confused. You have to look at three categories and have at least two symptoms of the 12 symptoms listed. So that gets to be a little complicated. So, again, let's start to just kind of talk about these things. And I want us to talk about it in terms of, again, the plain English version and what a parent might see, since parents comprise most of our audience here on our show. Okay, so to receive a diagnosis of autistic disorder, a child has to have six of the symptoms that we're going to talk about, and they have to be spread out among at least three categories. And the categories are going to be social interaction, or how a child interacts with other people, communication, and that would be the language skills, how much a child understands, how much a child uses language or gestures to communicate his wants and needs. And then there's also a behavior category. And again, those would be just the way that a child acts or interacts with his environment. Okay, so let's get started with the first category. Let's see how it has this organized. It really is talking about the social stuff first. And again, this would involve the way that a child uses nonverbal communication to interact with other people. And this would include a child's gestures, his body posture, facial expressions, or other mannerisms that send a message. And again, when you're looking at this with toddlers, sometimes I'll go in and talk to a parent about that, and they'll say, well, he can't communicate. That's why you're here. He's not using any words. And they don't realize, no, but there's so much that goes into looking at a child's communication skills or even the way he socially interacts other than waiting for him to walk up to you and say, hi, mommy, or you know, really use those formal words. There are lots of other things that we can look at. So,
ladies, we have a caller.
Okay. Caller, it's a little early in the show, but we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead.
That's great.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just know about your show through a friend. At the moment, I'm not able to get it through my computer. But,
okay.
She told me that y'all were talking about autism tonight, and I am a mother with a six-year-old who has autism, and I'll take any chance I can get to share with other parents, especially people who may not have a diagnosis, but still, you know something's going on, and, it just helps to hear other people's stories sometimes, I think.
Oh, it does. So tell us about, you have a six-year-old, did you say a little boy?
Yes, have a little boy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when was he diagnosed?
He was officially diagnosed October of 2006. He was four when we finally got a diagnosis.
Okay, so tell us about that process.
Well, when he was about 18 months old was when I really started realizing that there were problems.
Uh-huh.
We were using no words. We were using no gestures, and I had mentioned it to my pediatrician, you know, is there something I need to be concerned about, even before that, and he was my first child, and
uh-huh.
The pediatrician I was using said, oh, you're a first-time mother, you just worry too much, and, you know,
wow.
And I'm afraid that a lot of times parents get blown off like that. Because, unfortunately, a lot of doctors seem to be, because I went through a lot of doctors before we finally got a diagnosis.
Did you really? So you started with your pediatrician. Where did you go after that? Did you go
Pediatrician, I went to more than one pediatrician.
Wow.
And then I ended up talking to my doctor who didn't even see children, below the age of 18. And she, you know, directed me towards a neurologist.
Uh-huh.
And so we went to the first neurologist and basically got the same song and dance. The first neurologist we went to, and at that time he was, I think he was two by then. This neurologist told me, well, you're a first-time mom. I think you do too much for your child. It's probably why he's not talking.
Wow.
And, you know,
put it all on you, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's very disheartening to a parent because you're looking at your child and you're saying that your child is not interacting with other children in any way, or even if they try, they're not really sure what to do or how to do it. And because
right.
they're not
how
verbal,
did he? How did he interact with you at that point?
With me, he would pull on me. You know, he'd come pull on me. And but he has just started pointing. I mean, just
wow.
And we've
yeah.
been in therapy big time since we got the diagnosis. But you know, basically, it was just one of those things. I had been around him enough that his little grunts and cries, I knew what they were. But he couldn't communicate to anyone else. Like if I had to leave him with a sitter who didn't know him. Well, I couldn't do that because he would have a meltdown. And at
right.
the time,
so
I didn't know what a meltdown was.
right.
you know,
but
I just thought, well, we're having temper tantrums, but.
Yeah, and so doctors really blew that off. When you would talk about the temper tantrums
yeah.
and stuff, they just said, oh, he's two. They didn't really understand
exactly.
what you meant
exactly.
by that.
Right.
When you were interpreting his behaviors, I mean, that was really you doing the communicating kind of for him at that point because you said he wasn't really interacting with you. You did say that he would lead you. Did he start doing that? How old was he when he started doing that? He would just
he was probably about three when he started doing that.
Okay.
He would get things himself.
Yeah.
You know, if he knew where something was that he wanted, he would get it himself.
Right.
But as far as, you know, communicating to me in any way that he wanted something, there's just none of that.
Right.
And
so you had to do all of that interpreting,
right.
and then the doctor took that as that it was kind of your fault, that you were doing too much
exactly.
instead of really realizing that he had a huge language problem, communication
exactly.
problem, and social problem.
And, you know, they didn't. It was like when I would say to them, he does not use words. I just really ran into a lot of, oh, well, he's just too young, you know. But, I mean,
and
he's
a boy.
Like,
they probably
exactly.
said
boys
he's a boy.
I heard that a lot. Boys are so different from girls because
mm-hmm.
I had three nieces that I had, you know, seen go through these stages. And I did have one doctor say, well, boys are just so different from girls. But they're not that different.
well,
no. Right.
You know, I mean,
so,
as a parent, you know, as a parent, you have a gut feeling. That there's something going on that's not exactly right, and you just have to keep, you know. Thankfully now, I feel like the awareness is a lot better.
Right, even than
four years
ago.
Exactly. It, just within the last 2 years, it's just been phenomenal. The amount
right.
of attention that it has gotten, because it is such an epidemic.
Yeah.
It's of epidemic proportions. I mean, one in 150 kids, one in 99 boys.
Right. We were just talking about
that
statistic. That's
amazing.
That is amazing. Let me ask you one more question.
Okay.
Who formally diagnosed him? Who, you said you went to several different doctors. Who did you finally go to that said, this is autism, this is what you're looking at?
We went to a neurologist, a pediatric neurologist, with Le Bonheur Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
And he finally, you know, he spent about 5 minutes, within 5 minutes of being with my child, he said, okay, we're dealing with some type of autism here, but we've got to figure out, because there is a spectrum. Now, he does, we have an autistic disorder diagnosis.
Do you?
He's starting to be, you know, more functioning. At the beginning, we had no, I mean, it was just, it was like having a four-year-old that was still one, you know, a baby.
Yeah. So tell us what kinds of services you've done.
We do occupational therapy. We do speech therapy. We do physical therapy. We use something called talk tools.
Uh-huh.
We do that both in speech therapy and at home. But we don't. I'm so blessed. I have the best team of therapists. They work together. They're in one location. And we just kind of tailor things to my child because, and it should be that way. I feel like it should be that way with all children because none of these children are going to fit into a mold. So you have to take all these different things and say, well, this works and this works and this works. We do a lot of floor term. Sitting, you know, sitting, rolling around on the floor, playing.
Right.
Just like you do with a little baby, but with him, it has really brought him out of his shell.
And he's making good progress now.
Absolutely. He will look you in the eye now where he had never done that before. He'll look you in the eye, he will say, I want, he uses the words, I want, you know, and he'll fill in the blank. Now, we're not carrying on conversations yet, but we'll get there eventually.
You're getting there. Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experiences with us.
Well, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity as parents to do that.
We'd love to hear from parents. And unfortunately, I tried to stop Laura before to say when we were talking about going to the team assessment, you know, to go to a group assessment or with a psychologist. And I wanted to say I'm always kind of the cautionary, be careful about the pediatricians because I see a fair number of kids. The story is very similar to yours where the parents say, well, the doctor said not to worry. The doctor said he's a late talker. The doctor said, just like your initial pediatrician said, well, you just do everything for him. It's like, oh, that breaks my heart when I hear parents say that because I know darn well within 5 minutes it's not that. You know,
right.
Not my place to say what it is, but I know darn well. I mean, lots of parents meet their children's every need, and they develop as typical as any other child, and this has nothing to do with how those kids are parented. So, you know, they really. I'm thrilled and happy for you and your child that you pushed on, because some parents say, "Well, doctor says not to worry. I'm not going to worry," and you know, the days, months, and years tick by and they're not getting any answers or any help. So you were very smart to keep on it, and boy, you had to go through a lot to get there.
You did have to go through a lot, and the main thing I want parents to know is you are your child's best advocate.
Right.
You have to be your child's advocate. So don't just swallow things hook, line, and sinker. If you know something's wrong, then you keep looking until you find an answer.
Right.
Well,
because if you hadn't, you know, I doubt you'd be where you are now. It sounds like it took a lot of time and effort and commitment to get there. And I've certainly had parents who they say, well, you know, they might get first steps, but they really aren't committed to being that advocate for their child because they really, of course, every parent wants to hear, don't worry, it's nothing, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know, we all want to hear that. But if it really is something, then you really kind of do have to push on and seek other advice, and you sounds like you went on and on and on and on, but you got there, you know.
Yes.
And it is better. I mean, I think that happens less and less, but it certainly still does happen today, you know.
Right.
All right, go ahead, Laura.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you again for calling. We really appreciate hearing from a parent who's kind of been there, done that with the whole diagnostic loop. And again, I just want to congratulate you on being really persistent and pushing through until you got answers for your little boy.
Thank you so much, and thank you guys for your show, and I can't wait till I can actually listen to it on the computer.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling.
Join us
thank
again.
You.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Boy, okay. That is a familiar tune, isn't it? I see it a lot.
Is.
Hear it a lot. Mm-hmm.
It is, and oh, it just breaks my heart when she went to doctors. She did the right thing. She did what she was supposed to do, and you know it is good for her that she kept being persistent and that she didn't take no for an answer, and she kept kind of pushing through because she knew in her. She said she had a gut feeling. She knew something was wrong. So that was so great. I'm so glad she called.
Right.
Okay. So let's go back to what we were talking about, the three big categories. And again, let me remind you, the categories that we're looking at, kids with autism have difficulties in social interaction, in communication, and in behavior. So let's look at the symptoms from the social category, and that would be, the first thing would be problems developing a range of nonverbal behaviors. And again, that would include babies who don't make eye contact, who don't return big smiles by 6 months. So if you have a 2-year-old who is not really making eye contact with you, who isn't just responding joyfully and gleefully and just like lights up all over his little body, you know, that's a big, big concern because babies should be able to do that consistently by 6 months. So that would tell you that there's something going on in that social category. Do you want to talk about some of those other things, Kate, with the whole nonverbal thing?
The big ones that, and we, you know, oftentimes get referrals when a child is at or around 2, sometimes 18 months, when parents begin to have some concern about communication. And the big ones, especially by 2, if a child doesn't, and that our caller just said her son just mastered or just began to point, and he's 4, but pointing, the lack thereof, is, I think, a pretty big red flag for kids that we, you know, that's missing. And the other one that kids do so early, typically, I think my assessment tool says 6 to 9 months, is waving. You know,
right.
You wave to them, they wave back. You leave the room, you wave, they wave. It's a fun little game that kids just naturally pick up. It's not something we even have to really work on. With most kids, you know, typically developing kids, but kids on the spectrum, they're not pointers and they're not wavers, nor do they really do much imitation of, even if it's, you know, how you just grab your hand and like, come here, come here. Most kids, if you do some simple movement like that, they're very in tune and interested in imitating, and those kids kind of look at you or don't look at you, as the case may be,
yeah.
And don't really respond. You know, it's kind of like that doesn't really have any meaning to them.
Right.
So they don't really tend to imitate any of those things either.
Other gestures that I think about are so huge are shaking your head no.
Mm-hmm.
Kids who are developing typically really master that head shake no by about 12 months. You know, or they're sticking their hands out like, no, no, no. And again, they're communicating with you nonverbally. And it's not that they're doing it, let's see, I'm not even sure how to word this. They're doing it very purposefully to you. They're looking you right in the eye when they're doing it. Again, they may not be using those words, but it is very communicative. And it certainly is. Could be in a response to a question that you ask them or when you're trying to offer them something. You know, kids who are developing typically, even if they're not talking, often develop a huge range of gestures and ways that you know what they want. And again, it's not by, like that mom said, by you just kind of reading their minds and knowing what a little means. It's that they are doing lots of different things to help you understand what they want, even without words.
Another early one is that looking up and reaching to you to be held.
Right.
You know, that's frequently lacking in kids who are on the spectrum. They don't seem to have that instinct. One, they're not going to make the eye contact, which is really so basic to communication, typically. You know, you look at somebody in kids, when I'm around typically developing kids, I think, whoa, he never took his eyes off of me the whole time I played with him or talked to him. And these kids aren't only not looking at you generally, but they don't even reach up to be held. Even though they may want to be held, they don't have that instinct to reach up to say, hey, you up there, pick me up. That's an
early
one. Right.
or when you walk in their room and their cribs and they're not reaching out for you, and not purposefully doing something other than crying to get your attention. You know, I'll hear that a lot from children who go on to be diagnosed with autism. Even if they haven't gotten that diagnosis when I first get there, I might say to a mom, how does he call you? How does he let you know what he wants? Or like when he wakes up and a mom might say, well, he doesn't really do that. Or he cries, and I just kind of hear him banging around in there. You know, that's a big red flag that he's not knowing that he needs to initiate that social interaction to get what he wants.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on. The second social symptom in the social category would be problems developing peer relationships that would be appropriate for a child's developmental level. And so, again, we know that young children don't really do a lot of the typical turn-taking or playing together until they're closer to three. But a lot of times children, nearly all the time, children with autism that are even between two and three really might not even have an awareness that another kid is there. And parallel play is what we call it when the children are playing beside each other but not necessarily together. But you can still see them looking at each other, laughing with each other, and, again, being aware that another child is there.
So they may all be at the, say they're in a daycare setting, you'll see a group of three or four kids and they all are digging down in the box of blocks and taking them out, and they're kind of each working on their own little project, but they're all kind of doing it together. And there's some social interaction, maybe not at all words, but they're watching and paying attention to it. And the child at risk is the one who's off on the other side of the room, kind of self
in his own little world,
really pays very little, if any, attention to the group of kids. They're just kind of off finding something that they're interested in, but don't really even seem aware that, boy, there's a group of kids over there. I'll go get some blocks, too. They, in fact, oftentimes seem to avoid it.
Yeah, you're right about that. One thing, too, I think children between two and three, one thing they can hardly resist when other kids are around or joining in like a gross motor game, meaning that if they see two or three kids kind of running across the room, typically developing kids stop what they're doing and they start to run with those other kids, and it just becomes a huge exciting thing for them all to do. And again, that's a real big red flag if you have a child that will not even drop what he's doing, his own little isolated play, to join in a big thing like that with other children. That's a big red flag. Okay, the third social problem would be fails to seek attention, to share interest, achievements, or pleasure with other people. And the example that this gives with that is typically developing children spontaneously draw out your attention to show you an accomplishment. They might bring you a toy. They might, or even if it's something happy they're going to show you, or if there's something that's gone wrong, their shoe is untied. They're going to get your attention and want you to kind of help them there with that. Again, they're seeking you out. It's not that you have to figure them out or figure out what's wrong or, again, interpret those little things. They walk up to you, they approach you, they get your attention.
Other related things would be, you know, they do something and you respond. Guess what? Typically, developing kids will do it again and again and again because
right.
they love that positive response. And kids on the spectrum, I think that's something that almost has to be taught. You know, it's
right.
not really an instinct. And heaven knows we work on that, don't we, Laura?
Right. I was going to say, we'll talk about this in a couple of weeks, but doing the whole, yay, and clapping and clapping and making a huge big deal out of every single thing they do.
But
we're not
sharing,
talking about treatment tonight, yeah.
Yeah, but sharing things that they're interested in, just if they have a cool toy, they have something they like, they might walk over to you and hold it up and smile at you like, isn't it cool? Again, they don't need any words for that. They just have an instinct that I'm going to share this cool thing with my mommy or my daddy or whomever. And they don't seem to, again, have that. The other one is seeking help. You know, they don't necessarily, they're having some issue with it. A lot of times what I see kids on the spectrum do is try a little bit, get mad, throw it, get frustrated, give up, and typically
and they don't even They don't even think, oh, I can take this to a big person and they can help me with this. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
There's no recognition there.
Right.
And no initiation. Yeah. Okay. The fourth thing would be that the child fails to respond to social and emotional cues. And again, the professional term for that would be reciprocity. And you were talking about that, the back and forth turn taking that we do, even without words, the social, you smile at them, they smile back. You wave at them, they wave back. And again, typically developing kids love those kinds of games and they want to hook you into that and have you maybe play peekaboo with them, not just one or two times, but sometimes, you know, I go in and see children and they are, you know, they want me to do it 30 times and keep on and on and on. And again, they get a big kick out of that whole back and forth piece.
Yeah, the example they give is they also don't get excited about opening presents or seeing their parents after they've come home from work. Even though sometimes you can see that a child on some level does respond with affection to their mom or dad, that they've come home, typical kids are going to be, you know, if it's daddy, they're running, they want to jump in his lap, they want to, you know, they're just so excited to see him. And
right.
Kids on the spectrum, it's just kind of, not necessarily.
Yeah. Maybe a little look.
Yeah.
Maybe a look in dad's direction. But again, no real excitement, no real anticipation. They haven't understood when mommy said, oh, I think daddy's home. I think I hear his car. You know, again, they're not really processing those words, not understanding that. And especially when they see dad, they might not look up from looking at the wheels on the train to, or it's just a fleeting little thing. Again, no real social and emotional connection there. And I do want to talk about that a little bit, Kate. You always give such a great example of kids who are on the spectrum who the moms say, well, he can't be autistic because he does connect with me. And then talk about that a little bit, because you talked about that a few weeks ago on the show about how there's just such a qualitative difference in how those kids, even though those parents might think that they're interacting with them or connected with them, give that great example that you gave a few weeks ago.
Well, which great example was that? No.
Remember how we...
Oh, no, I know. I'm teasing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I talked about, and I had a mom, in fact, say that, real-life person telling me that her child was really very connected. She was not concerned about her being on the spectrum at all, because her reason was the child was very loving, she thought, with her, and the child did, in fact, seek her out, going to sit in her lap, and she especially liked to kind of crawl on her and climb on her, and you know, there was some physical connection there. And I've actually seen that in kids who had a full diagnosis of autism. I don't think that's really so uncommon. The difference, it is really a qualitative difference. The difference would be a typically developing child would have been right there looking at her mommy or showing her mommy things, or, and this was a very physical, this is comforting to me, so I'm going to snuggle in your lap, when the child was 2.5. I mean, when it wasn't a baby, it was a child who was 2.5 and certainly had things she liked and had some strengths, but really very little eye contact with her mother, very little shared attention. It was all very, very physical and endearing to the mother, but yet not at all what you would expect, you know, on a
from
social
a
level. Right,
yeah.
From a child that
yeah.
age. So, was that the example?
That was the example, and I always think about my little guy that didn't get a diagnosis of autism at 2, but I know eventually that he will, probably when he hits kindergarten. But his mom used to say all the time, he can't be autistic because he connects with me. And she would always use the example that he would stand in the kitchen and come up and initiate with her. And I think I used this on the show a couple of weeks ago too, but he would wrap his arm around her leg.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he would do. And again, no looking up at her, no pulling her down to him, nothing else beyond just that arm kind of wrapped around her leg. And that was how she felt like, that's enough, or that's, you know, he is connected to me because of that. And again, in his way, he did physically get close to her, but there was no real emotional back and forth there.
Right.
So it's a
that reciprocity thing was missing. Yeah, and I think, you know, in fact, kids on the spectrum in those sorts of ways are very connected to their loved ones. You know, a lot of times they
right.
do seek them out when they're threatened, and they can be fairly easily threatened. And so, you know, I've certainly seen kids who ended up with diagnoses who absolutely cowered in their mother's lap and wouldn't let anybody else get near them. And you could say, well, yeah, they're very attached, but yet it wasn't really, even when it was just the two of them, their connection wasn't at all like that you would see in a typically developing kid. There wasn't eye contact, there wasn't shared attention, there wasn't any
right.
kind of nonverbal communication. It was, save me. You know,
right.
really that's
right.
what the child communicated. Save me, mommy. They were
right.
scared to death of strangers, but wasn't
and sometimes
really
mothers, you know, like that mother talked about before, she was a first-time mother, so she didn't really have anything to compare it to. So if that's your situation and you're thinking, oh, that's kind of how, that's what they're talking about, that's kind of what my child does, give that whole social, emotional connection another look and another thought, because, again, if they're not really initiating with you and have lots of those back and forth exchanges, you know, we're talking about that. It may not be the same kind of quality as we would expect from a child, your child's own age, with his mom. Okay, let's move on. We've just gotten through the social piece. We only have
yeah, this,
8 minutes left.
Surprise, surprise, it's going to take longer. We do like to ad lib, don't we?
Okay, what's our
next one?
The next one, okay, so out of that category, if your child has two out of those four social problems with using a range of nonverbal behaviors, problems developing peer relationships that would be appropriate for his age, he fails to seek the attention of others to share interest, achievements, or pleasure, and fails to respond to social and emotional cues. If your child has two of those, he is at risk for autism. So let's move on to the communicative section or the language section, and you're going to have to help me, Kate.
We could spend a week on this one.
Yeah, not go on and on and on. But number one, your child has a delay or absence of speech with no attempts to compensate by using gestures. And again, we've already talked about this. Children who are at risk for autism don't point to what they want. They don't indicate with head shakes and nods, yes and no. And they also don't try to make you understand what they want using little body language. You know, they don't... let's see, a good example of that would be if a kid fell down and hurt his knee, but he couldn't tell you that he's hurt, and you might say, what's wrong, what's wrong? Well, a typically developing kid, even without saying, I hurt my knee, might look at his knee and then look back at you or do some pointing to his knee and, again, let you know in some way what's wrong. A typically developing kid who wants something to drink is going to try to come up with a way to show you that. They're going to point at the cup. They're going to try to grab the cup. But, again, not just to be independent and do it themselves, but they're going to be looking at you and realize, oh, mommy is going to make this much more efficient for me if she actually helps me do it. Hey, didn't you think that was great what the other mom said, is that what she pointed out about that her child was just very independent, that
mm-hmm.
he kind of did things for himself, and again, he did not make that connection that I can communicate with somebody else and make this happen for me sooner. Kids with autism don't get that.
Right, and I had a local pediatrician say that to a mother of a child I see about 6 months ago. He's just a boy, and he's very independent. And not so much, yeah. I think that's
not the problem, yeah.
Nope. There's independence, and certainly lots of young toddlers, two-year-olds can be independent. But this is almost like a lack of awareness that mommy's there to help them,
right.
and they don't seek that help out. They just either do it themselves or try and fail and give up or try and get very frustrated and cry. But really, they don't go to their mommies and indicate in any way what they want. They just try and take care of it or give up, basically. Yeah.
Now, an older child with autism, and like that other mom said too, once he got to be about three, He did start to use his mom's hands to do stuff for him. But again, when you see that, you'll know that there's a qualitative difference. It's like it's like they don't realize that there's a person connected to those other hands. And they've just learned, okay, these big hands are somehow better than mine to make this happen, so I'm going to grab them and make them push the button, or I'm going to grab them and make them open the door. But again, there's the lack of eye contact when they're doing it. There's a lack of real, that reciprocity word again, that turn-taking. They may lead you. They may pull you. They may take your hands and try to do it. But again, there's nothing beyond that that lets you know that they're trying to communicate with them. And I think that throws lots of parents off too. Don't you think that I've heard parents of kids who've gone on to be diagnosed with autism say, no, he pulls me. He pulls me to what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you look at it, there's that qualitative difference. He's not really looking at her when he's doing it. He's not. He doesn't share the excitement if he's making his mom push the button or get what he wants. There's no big grin back at her like, hey, we did it.
Yeah, I'm going to make you do it. Look, I'm two and I can make you do what I want. And they're smiling at you or grinning.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like take the body part and put it on the thing.
Right.
And to me, honestly, when I see a child behave that way and there is the lack of eye contact and the, you know, shared idea between what if the child does it, and I do have kids do that, when it's just move the hand, it's a major red flag to me. You know, I think, oh.
You say that all the time because, you know, and we've had this conversation a lot because I'll say, no, pulling and leading is communicative. And you always go, yeah, but that's all they can do. You know, because, again, it is when you think about there's no other nonverbal communication going on with that. There's no smiling. There's no looking at it. Or there's no, you know, a kid with autism who's trying to pull his mom like that really might get mad if mom doesn't come. But when a kid who's typically developing is doing that to kind of compensate for when he wants his mom to help him, again, he's looking at her and he's using those puppy dog eyes like, please come help me. Yeah. And again, communicating with this little face that, gosh, I really need your help here, rather than just trying to use her body part to accomplish a task.
Mm-hmm. And usually what I see when it is the behavior that disturbs me or gives me reason for concern is they're fixated on the object. You know,
right.
They want
the
can
yeah.
or stir of crackers open. They've tried. They can't do it. They take your hand. They put it on there. They're still sitting there staring at the can thinking, I want it open. But they don't look at me or their mom or whomever to indicate, hey, you up there, you looking at me? This is what I want. And that's
right.
A big, huge piece that's been, and, you know, it is some acknowledgement or some understanding, I guess, on the child's part that they can get help, but it's about the hands. It's really not about, I'm going to get this person to do
right.
what I want them to do by looking at them. And,
right.
You know. So, yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Let's move on.
Okay.
All right, the second symptom under the language section is if speech develops, a child will not be able to start or carry on a conversation. And again, this would be spontaneous speech is the key. And boy, I could talk for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks on this one point alone. But children with autism really don't initiate a conversation. They don't answer questions. They may be talking. They may be quoting the line from Dora that they heard. They may be saying what they've heard mom or dad say a lot of times. They may just be labeling. But again, there's a real lack of spontaneous speech or of them coming up with it on their own or putting it together when they haven't really been echoing what they've heard someone say. The next point is it's not uncommon for children with autism to parrot phrases that comes from books, videos, music, or another person. Again, the professional term for that is echolalia. We are going to have at least one show about this because it is a huge topic on the website. I get questions about it a lot. Echolalia is hard to treat. Oh, my goodness. I just could work myself into a frenzy sometimes thinking about what am I going to do for this kid. But again, we're going to talk about how to treat that on a later show. But what echolalia is, again, just maybe imitating or saying a whole paragraph that they've heard from a television show, or maybe singing a whole entire song, yet not being able to ask for milk when they need it, or saying a little line that you say to them, you know, they might say, hold you, when you've said to them a lot, do you want me to hold you? So they try to initiate even that whole thing with just, again, that little line that they've echoed from a previous conversation.
And I have certainly had the kids that do the know the song from whatever DVD video they're into. And parents, you know, in the long run, it may not be such a bad thing, but it should be a real, as you said, huge red flag reason for concern if a child can go through a whole exchange that they've seen on Dora or a whole song and yet have really no words that they used, or one or two words, and yet they know a whole song to communicate with their loved ones, you know. I mean,
right.
I've had parents
and again,
say, well, she can talk when she wants to, and it's like, well, only if it's the Dora the Explorer song, and, you know, that's
right. And it
really
does, you know, and again, echolalia in and of itself with a kid with autism really is kind of a positive sign. It does kind of indicate, okay, they are going to be able to talk. We've just got to channel that. But again, today we're just talking about the diagnostic criteria, and if that's the only real communication, the only real words that a kid that that you've have, you know, you're a parent of, or a child you're concerned about, if that's their only language, you know, again, that's a red flag. If they're not using words to initiate conversations, initiate getting requests, and initiate requests or getting their wants and needs met, that's a real red flag. Another one under the language category would be no pretend play, and that would be that a child doesn't use his imagination on his own. And, oh, my goodness, again, Kate, this would be what you could talk about for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, that lack of imaginative play. And you want to talk about this example, I'm sure, because you talk about this all the time.
Well, the example they give, they went with a number one example. A child does not use imagination when he rolls the wheels of a train back and forth or spins them. But taking the same train and picking up passengers at a make-believe station and dropping them off at a park is. So, and that's, you know, for our age group, because we only see kids under three in our early intervention program in Kentucky, but the example they give is a little advanced, and I wouldn't necessarily be concerned if a three-year-old didn't have exactly that, but some idea that they are pretending that their early concept of, I can put the people in the car, and we might say they're going to the park or the zoo or the store or, you know, some early, or we can feed the baby, and the baby might go potty, and then we'll put her on the potty, and then she doesn't want juice, she wants milk, and lots of those things can really be acted out or played even without a whole lot of words. And, you know, I think kids are better at those sorts of things when they have language, but young children get babies drink the bottle, we pat the baby, baby goes night-night.
You know. That's on my language test at 12 to 15 months, that kids are able to do that and initiate that kind of play in a sequence. And then when you give them directions, you know, the baby's thirsty, give her a drink, you know, and really kind of are pretending to feed Elmo a cookie. That's how early that kind of play skill is. It's at 12 to 15 months. So if you have a 2-year-old who's not doing that kind of play, and if your 2-year-old's favorite fascination is, you know, laying on his belly, on his tummy, watching the wheels spin on the train, again, that's not really play. That's him being hyper-focused on that spinning object. So you need to look carefully at a child's play skills and really kind of tease out what would be imaginative and creative. And again, I try to think about it is if they'll do lots of steps in a row. You know, a typically developing kid, even if he has no words yet, you know, he's just a late talker, is still going to be pushing the train on the track and then maybe trying to put him in the little station and closing the door and then knocking on the door for the train to come back out again. And then, you know, we're excited, we see the train again, and then pushing it back again and hooking it with another train, not just watching the wheels or not just overly fascinated with lining the trains up. there are going to be lots of variation in that play, lots of different actions going on, not just the same one or two things back and forth. The other thing that kind of is a red flag with that kind of play for me is if a kid gets really upset if you try to interject yourself into that play.
Mm-hmm.
Kids who are on the spectrum get sometimes just get so mad if you're not really hooking those magnetic trains together, or you're going to take the train away so that they're not able to look at those wheels. They're not able to really tell that you're joking or that it's a game and that they don't necessarily know you're going to give it right back either. You know, they're so kind of hooked in that little routine that they're doing that, and again, that's not really play. They don't understand that.
And that tends to be, that's what they'll do over and over and over. And, yeah, they don't move beyond that and try and disrupt it. And, whoo, you know, they do communicate that they're mad you messed up their system, because that's what they're. And do you think perseverative play is an appropriate thing to call that, Laura?
Yeah, and perseverative means they're stuck. They can't get past it. And, again, they don't want you to introduce a lot of new ideas. It's not, and again, it's not just that they're a stubborn toddler, which is what parents will say too. Oh, he's just stubborn. That's the only thing he likes to do. Or, oh, he's just two. He only wants his way. Again, it's beyond that. It's that they really can't move beyond that same little set of play, because they're not cognitively, meaning their thinking skills and language-wise, able to move on, or their little sensory systems that we've talked about in the past few weeks. They get so much of a jolt from that same little repetitive activity that they want to do it over and over and over and over and over. Okay. The last category, you know, we've talked about the big ones. We've talked about the social characteristics that might make a child at risk for autism, or that help a team of professionals diagnose that a child is autistic. We've talked about the social stuff. We've talked about the language stuff. And the last category involves behaviors. And, again, this is just what we're talking about. Think of a child who resists change at all cost, repeats a behavior over and over, or becomes preoccupied with the parts of an object rather than the whole toy. And so a child to be diagnosed with autism would have one of the following four symptoms: an interest or action of intense or abnormal focus. And, again, this would be a child who has really limited interest. He only likes trains, or he only likes Hot Wheels cars, or he only likes blocks with letters. You know, it would be that other things that a parent might introduce he doesn't like. He's got a whole toy room full of stuff, but he might only really like a certain kind of toy. Or he might just be so hyper fixated on it that he only wants that TV show on, you know, gets really, really mad if mom tries to introduce another video. So, again, it's abnormally focused on something. The second one would be that a child rigidly follows a routine or ritual that has no purpose. That would be a kid who wants to sit and open and close, open and close, open and close a door without going through it. You want to give some more examples of that one, Kate?
Lining up cars in the same order, or insisting on the same routine to the grocery store. Parents, you know, tend to think of these as, particularly the same routine to the grocery store, that a kid's just demanding, difficult, you know, and the lining up the cars. I've certainly had lots of those kids, or they always put things in the same color order, or they always, and parents do recognize, yeah, if you change it, woo-wee, does he get mad. You know, that's like they are bound and determined to do it their way, and they do it the same way over and over and over.
Right. The third category, symptom, we've got 90 seconds, I think, to wrap this up. A kid who does repetition of a particular movement or gestures. Hand flapping is kind of the classic autism movement that lots of people think about, you know, and you've heard the people that say, oh, I thought it was so cute, I thought he was just an angel, I'm going to fly away. Anything like that. Hand flapping, rocking, the other examples I give, pacing, toe walking. Yeah, pacing to me looks like the kid that might go around the perimeter of a room over and over and over, and they might have their hand out, and they're just kind of touching everything as they go. But, again, there's no real purpose behind that. They're just pacing, just kind of doing that. We call those self-stimulatory behaviors, or STEMs is kind of how professional people abbreviate that. Kate, I think we put a little adjective form on there, STEMI. We'll say that STEMI behavior. And again, those mannerisms are characterized as stereotypic behaviors because they're inappropriate, because they're persistent, and because they're repetitive. And lastly, the last symptom of there would be children who are persistently preoccupied with parts of an object. And again, that would be the kids who only want to look at the wheels of the car or the train, the kids who are hyper-focused on the eyes of a doll, or kids who also become so absorbed with things that are not really appropriate for that, like these might be the sniffers, again, for toys and things, not necessarily something that you would automatically smell, or they might become focused on moving or shiny objects. I've seen kids do that where they're always, they want to flip over the back of all those push-button toys because they're looking at the screws. They're always trying to find the screws on the toys. Yeah, that would be that. But again, those would be the four kind of behavior symptoms. So that is what was called the plain English interpretation of the DSM-4 criteria for autism. Again, it's not a specific test. It's just that the professionals would use these symptoms or behaviors and look to see if your child met those. And if your child did meet those criteria, he would get a diagnosis of autism. If your child has some of those but not all of those, he might get what's called pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, meaning that he didn't quite meet the diagnostic definition for autism, but that he did show impairments in those areas that we just talked about. So that's our first show about autism. In the next week, we're going to talk about some other checklist that we have that, again, for parents who might be on the fence saying, do I need to get a referral? Is this what we're looking at? Is this why my kid's not talking? We're going to talk about that again next week in detail. The week after that, we're going to have our friend on, Dr. Lisa Powell, who's going to give us the official way to diagnose autism and talk to us about some of the tools that they use. And then in December, we're going to finally get to talk about treatment, which is what we do know about and what we do every day in our practices as speech pathologists and developmental intervention. So I'm most excited about those shows, but I think that we need to get through the diagnostic criteria first, and so that we're all on the same page with that.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks for a good show, Kate.
Okay. Talk to you
later.
Talk
to you next week. Bye.